21st, 2012. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm coming to you from the suburbs of Chicago. Thanks for listening to me today, and thanks for listening to RBN. To see the guest schedule for this program, please visit the radio schedule page at spingola.com. You may see a list of the guests together with links to their websites and other interesting sites. I also have an email list that one may join to receive a weekly announcement of the scheduled guests and any other special announcements. I have linked it to today's date. For questions or comments during the program, please email spingola1 at yahoo.com. I will be hosting a debate on the Holocaust this Friday, June 22nd, on this program between Friedrich Paul Berg and Roberto Muhlenkamp. Some of the RBN listeners have asked me how I find such a wide variety of interesting guests. I cannot take any credit for today's guest, as he initially approached me and was kind enough to send me a recently published book, The Lost Worlds of Ancient America, which just came out. Well, I already said that, didn't I? That's kind of redundant. Of which he is the editor. My guest today is Frank Joseph, the former editor-in-chief and now a correspondent of the Ancient American Magazine, a popular science magazine describing overseas visitors to our continent before Columbus. Its website is ancientamerican.com. There's an introductory 4-minute video on the website that is very fascinating. Politicians call the indigenous population savages in order to steal their land. Yet this video presents a very different view. There are also other videos that are lengthier that I invite you to watch. Welcome to the program, Frank.
Thank you very much. It's very good to be here on the summer solstice.
Indeed. Indeed. It is the 21st.
Yeah.
All righty. Now, you retired as editor of Ancient American Magazine in 2007, correct?
Yes, I was working with the magazine from its inception in 1993, and it got kind of overwhelming with my other book projects. So I'm still associated with the magazine as a correspondent, but I'm no longer editor-in-chief.
Okay. Now, you are the author of a series of books on ancient civilization, including Atlantis and 2012, The Destruction of Atlantis, The Lost Civilization of Lemuria, Survivors of Atlantis, The Lost Treasure of King Juba, Discovering the Mysteries of Ancient America, and the Atlantis Encyclopedia. That sounds like quite a body of work.
Yes, and that's not even all of them, unfortunately.
Right. Now, you do have quite a resume, which I have linked on today's date on my radio schedule page, which talks about all the other things that you have written. And didn't you also co-author the book, Opening of the Ark of the Covenant, with your wife?
Yes, that's right. She and I worked on that project for a very long time, and that was released about 5 years ago now, and it's gone into several foreign editions in Brazil and Korea and so on. That one is the one we worked hardest and longest on.
All righty. Now, the book that you sent me, The Lost Worlds of Ancient America, is third, I believe I read it, it's third in a compilation of basically some of the articles that have appeared in the magazine?
Yeah. This one, though, I think is quite different. What I strove to do is to look over all of the many dozens, actually hundreds of issues that our magazine has come out with, since 1993, and I've selected what I feel are the most, represent the most persuasive physical evidence for ancient visitors to the Americas hundreds and thousands of years before Columbus. And
Frank, hold that thought. We do have to take a real quick 3-minute break. We will be right back with our guest today, Frank Joseph. Welcome back. Our guest today is Frank Joseph. He is the former editor-in-chief and now correspondent of the Ancient American Magazine. Their website is ancientamerican.com. Frank, do you have a website of your own?
No, we'll just stick with the magazines. That's good enough.
All righty. You were talking about some of the selections that you chose for this particular book that you sent me, and you said that you were kind of concentrating on the physical proof, which is the title of part one in this book. And then there are several articles.
Right. The great thing about our magazine is that it's open to not just academics and university-trained people, but also just to ordinary citizens who have found very bizarre artifacts, sometimes very anomalous finds, sometimes on their own property. And the first chapter, as a matter of fact, opens up with something of this nature. It was only a very few years ago, I think about 8 years ago, that a husband and wife were enlarging their basement in Los Angeles, California. They were digging it out deeper to put in, I believe, a new water heater. And in the process, they unearthed a large, unusual stone. When they dug it out, it stood about 4 feet high. It kind of resembles a rectangular cube. It's a dark red brownish stone. It's beautifully carved. And on one side, it represents the face of a woman in bas-relief with a very ornate hairstyle. It also has some geometric designs on two other sides. They took this strange-looking object to the Los Angeles Archaeological Museum, one of the finest in the world, as a matter of fact, and the archaeologists there confirmed that this was not a modern manufacturer that it had nothing to do with Native Americans, represented a culture they were unfamiliar with, and they dated it to at least 500 years of age. Turns out it's a lot older than 500 years, as the article points out and our own research was able to determine. This, in fact, is a Phoenician altar stone that goes back 3,000 years. It's known as a Tophet, T-O-P-H-E-T. The Phoenicians were a Near Eastern people, most related to the Lebanese people today. The Lebanese people are more or less the direct descendants of the ancient Phoenicians. And the Phoenicians were tremendous seafarers. They inherited this great maritime tradition from the Trojans and other earlier Bronze Age people. And the Phoenicians sailed to various parts of the Mediterranean, and we now know outside the Mediterranean. And the survival of this object, buried as deep as it was, indicates that it was in use about that time, about 3,000 years ago, in California, of all places. And this is not an anomalous find. It's not unique. And that's the purpose of the book, to bring out all these other wonderful discoveries that have been made to show that the oceans of the ancient world were not barriers to ancient human beings, but they were highways that were traveled.
Right. Very interesting. Now, how did you and Wayne May, the owner of the magazine, meet? And he started that magazine in 1993 when you joined?
Well, we both sort of started it together. He and I were always interested in bringing out these wonderful finds that have been made and are not publicized. We are the only magazine that discusses this rather hot topic, because if you go to any university in the United States today and open up a textbook on American history and prehistory, you'll see that American history begins with Columbus in 1492, and that before that time, nothing really of much significance happened. Well, we totally disagree with that point of view. We know for a fact that there were Celts that made a magnificent impact on prehistoric America. We know that the ancient Japanese now, through the DNA surveys that have been done, were here 20,000 years ago. Even earlier than that, Europeans from Normandy were here. Yes, go ahead.
So when did you become interested in ancient history, and what were you doing at that time?
Well, as a boy, I've always been interested, but I think what the change, I think, for both Mr. May and myself was the failure of our modern education, which just seemed to be an inadequate explanation of the origins of civilization, especially the stories that we had already heard. We're both residents of the upper Midwest. We heard these tales that Native American Indians have told about white men that came long ago, long before the modern Europeans, and that these white men brought all kinds of high magic or technology. And these stories, which are very important to Native American people, were disregarded as kind of fables and fantasies by archaeologists who don't take them seriously. Well, what we've been able to do now is to link up this Native American tradition with hard evidence that's been found and dated to show that these oral traditions are not just fantasies, that they are the remembrances, the folkish memories that are important to Native American people.
Right. Now, you said that you live in the upper, you've always lived in the upper Midwest?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Have you ever, I know you probably have, well, you live in Minnesota right now. Aren't
yes,
there some
I do, uh-huh.
ancient archaeological sites in southern Minnesota?
Oh, there are tremendous archaeological sites in our state and certainly in yours in Illinois as well. There is no state in the United States that's without a very rich history, which is sort of secret and cut off and unknown to the vast majority of our people. In Minnesota, we have something here called the Kensington Runestone. The Kensington Runestone was found in 1898 by an immigrant Swedish farmer about in the middle of the state, maybe about an hour's drive northwest of the Twin Cities. And while he was farming his land for the first time, he was uprooting an old tree. And in the roots of this tree were embracing a boulder about 3 feet long, weighs about 300 pounds, solid granite, and it's carved on three sides with a beautiful runic text. And the runes were a form of writing used by the Vikings and people after the Vikings, the Scandinavians, all the way through the Middle Ages, to record their most important events. And this runic stone has a date on it, very clear date, 1362. And it tells, it's text which is easily translated, it tells about an expedition from Scandinavia, from the island of Skane in the North Sea, that came to Minnesota on an expedition that was commissioned by King Magnus, King of Sweden, because at that time Sweden was being ravaged by the plague, a series of plagues, and the king was looking for a place of refuge. And this story that's told on the Kensington Runestone tells how these Scandinavians ran into trouble with the ancestors of Native Americans. There was a battle of some kind. And that this stone was set up as a memorial to them and also as a land claim. When this stone was first found in 1898, it was dismissed as a hoax by establishment archaeologists, who continued through the 20th century to say that it was just something faked up by the Swedish immigrant. And in our book, we're able to show that the Kensington Runestone was subjected to the most state-of-the-art geologic testing in a St. Paul laboratory by an award-winning geologist. His name is Scott Walter. And Scott Walter had not even heard of the Kensington Runestone before, but 5 years ago he was commissioned by the Kensington Runestone Museum to test the Kensington Runestone for authenticity, and the results of his test showed conclusively that the Kensington Runestone was carved about 500 to 600 years ago, that the deposition on the stone, its mineralization, could only have come from a stone that was buried for about 500 years. Now, this is something you're not going to read in the textbooks, even though his discovery is beyond all question. It is not discussed on television, and it is just literally shunned and ignored. And that's why it's important that our book, The Lost Worlds of Ancient America, brings to light some of these discoveries that are otherwise not discussed.
Right. Now, you wrote the introduction to this book, and you called the introduction Unlocking America's Forbidden Past. Now, do you see yourself as a pace setter in a movement to expand the horizons of what people have been and have indoctrinated us to accept by the so-called establishment archaeologists?
Well, I wouldn't call myself a pace setter so much, but I believe that I am part of a growing movement of sometimes academics, mainstream archaeologists, as well as everyday folks who are unhappy with the paradigm of Columbus being the first and only discoverer of America. This is not to denigrate Columbus's achievement, which was substantial. We have to understand that the Americas were chartered and explored thousands of years before Spain even existed. That's true, but with the fall of classical civilization, Europe went into a dark ages in which all this information was for the most part lost. and Columbus, being a Renaissance man, had to start all over again. So he represents a revival that I hope that I'm a part of, to show that the Americas were connected with Europe, especially with Europe, but other parts of the world, Asia as well, long before the official beginning of our country. It's our heritage. It's our legacy as Americans to find out how deep our history really goes. And it goes far deeper than we're told.
Right. All righty. We are coming up on a break here, and we will be right back with our guest, Frank Joseph. So stay tuned. Today is Frank Joseph, the former editor-in-chief and now correspondent of the Ancient American Magazine. Its website is ancientamerican.com, and there are some videos that I would recommend that people watch, including the introductory video. It's only about 4 minutes long, and it's very interesting because it says that some of the politicians who were seeking the indigenous population's land in order to take over the land and seize it and steal it, referred to this population as a bunch of savages. In other words, they marginalize these people in order to justify their plunder of the land. Correct?
Well, that's part of it. Unfortunately, history is always politics, and especially archaeology is politics. And it's like anything else, can be used or abused, I suppose.
Right. Now, you disagree with establishment archaeologists who suggest different time periods for the artifacts that you have written about.
Well, absolutely. I think that the mainstream archaeologists are not even interested in American prehistory. It's kind of a shocking thing to realize. I certainly assumed through my upbringing that once someone has gone through all the difficulty of becoming an archaeologist, they'd be interested in archaeology, right? No. A line has been drawn in the sand in American archaeology, and that's in 1492. Nothing of significance is supposed to have happened before then, and anything earlier than the arrival of Columbus is seen in the context of just purely Native American history, which is not the case at all. That American prehistory is extremely rich and interesting because primarily of its interaction with these other dynamic civilizations that arrived here in North America so long ago. Sometimes these people arrived as castaways. Other times they arrived as conquerors or as colonists or as miners. Many different stories going on. Pyramid builders. Most Americans don't even realize that there is a pyramid in Illinois, the base of which is larger than the Great Pyramid of Egypt. It's called Monk's Mound. It's right across the Mississippi River from St. Louis, Missouri. And this enormous structure was over 100 feet high, had over 30 million cubic yards of soil go into its construction. It is a step pyramid. It is precisely oriented to various astronomical phenomena, including today's day, by the way. It still is oriented to the sunrise of the summer solstice, along with other lunations, the appearance of the Pleiades, and so on. And that this civilization flourished more than 1,000 years ago and vanished. But who knows about it? Even though there's a great museum there, and it's open to the public, and you can see it, it's not publicized, because it's kind of an embarrassment. People ask too many questions like, who made this thing? What does this have to do with the Native American peoples here? The Native American peoples themselves say that it was created by a race that appeared from coming up from the south called the Snake People. And they possessed this high technology that was not otherwise available. So too many embarrassing questions are raised by this magnificent structure.
Now, do some of those establishment archaeologists attempt to discredit you for your activities and your writings, as well as others who write for the magazine?
Well, the only discredit, they just neglect or sort of a laughing dismissal. When Scott Walter, I mentioned earlier, proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that the Kensington runestone is authentic, that it was created by medieval visitors from Scandinavia, the reaction of the establishment was just to ignore it. He had no peer review. No one looked it over. He did have peer review amongst fellow geologists, and they confirmed his tests 100%, but not a single archaeologist took any interest in his work at all. The only response was a sort of an oblique reference to the stone as being an example of frontier humor. And that's all that was discussed. This is not the only object that's been verified by any means by geologic testing. See, archaeology is a soft science. It's interpretive, but geology is not. It's a hard science, and that leaves very little wiggle room for theories and opinions. And when geology overcomes archaeology in certain instances like this, the archaeologists clam up. Usually what they'll do is they'll say, you're racist if you say that there were other people that arrived here and made a contribution to prehistory. That is supposed to be a denigration of the Native American people, who themselves talk about these foreigners, mentioning specifically as white people who arrived in the ancient past. And it's sort of a knee-jerk reaction that I've found amongst mainstream scholars. They play the race card. See, you're supposed to back down after that because you say that the earliest civilization in America is white. It was created by Celts who arrived here 3,000 years ago. That civilization is known by archaeologists. They refer to it as the Adena. They know that it has numerous anomalies, like red-haired people that are found inside some of the mounds. Not discussed. But if you bring any of this up, why, you're a racist, say, for bringing that up.
What seems to be their objectives? We are going to break, so we'll pick this question up on the other side. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Frank Joseph. He is the former editor-in-chief and now a correspondent of the Ancient American Magazine. Its website is ancientamerican.com. And we were talking just before the break about the objectives of these so-called establishment archaeologists and their attempts to conceal these finds. I find that very extraordinary that they would want to do that.
It is extremely extraordinary and shocking to realize that there has been this almost uniform resistance to any information about American prehistory. It begins with a religious fanatic. His name was John Wesley Powell. He is regarded as the founding father of American archaeology. He lived at the turn of the 20th century. He did some very important work, no doubt about it. He brought a scientific regimen to archaeology, which was really just in the hands of antiquarians before him, some very good ones. Antiquarian is really just a rather unscientific, not university-trained approach to the ancient past. Well, he brought a university approach to it, did a fine job. Trouble is, when he set this up, he laid down as one of his commandments that no information before anything that indicates anything before 1492 is to be even considered. No evidence, no discussion, nothing. And that has become ingrained as an adamantine commandment accepted by archaeologists ever since. They have used that for their own agendas. Some have written their textbooks, which they sell to students, of course, year after year as part of their income, and they don't want to be able to change the textbooks because that would strike directly at their income. That's a very narrow, small way of looking at it. But for the most part, I would say American archaeologists have accepted Powell's dictum of nothing before 1492 as just part of their profession.
Right. Now, you mentioned that both you and Wayne May were dismayed with the educational system here in this country.
Right.
Now, didn't a lot of tax-exempt foundations kind of take over the educational system at about the same time that this gentleman established the rules and regulations for archaeology and at about the same time?
Well, that's a very brilliant insight. Hasn't been brought up on any interviews I've had before on this. Something that people don't like to touch, of course. It's a bit of a diversion, but I agree with you 100%. I think the regimentation of American education and the politicalization of it began about that same time. Correct. And it has become so fossilized now that you're getting less education than a specific point of view. It's more of an indoctrination, I'd say, than an education. I think all of us have lived through this period where we're seeing this now becoming more intense. It's a process that began about that time, in the early part of the 20th century, a concerted effort to raise the American people to conform in their thinking to a very specific way of looking at the world, whereas education before was to expand a person's mind so that he or she could think for themselves. Now, of course, that's not the idea. You're not supposed to think for yourself. You're supposed to believe what you're told. And I think that's a chief difference that began exactly as you say about 100 years ago.
It is interesting. I mean, we know that often people will conceal their own background for various reasons, but for a body of educators, so-called educators, to conceal or attempt to dismiss or marginalize discoveries that might make us and basically these discoveries would make us question our own history and culture.
They'd make us question also the people that have told us for all these generations that all this is a bunch of nonsense. So they cannot admit that even one piece of evidence is legitimate because their entire ivory tower would collapse. That's how fragile they are. If they were to admit that the Kensington Runestone is in fact legitimate, as it is, that would bring into question all this other evidence, this huge body of evidence, which shows that there were people from Northern Europe, from Western Europe, even from West Africa, that made impacts on Mexico, certainly from Japan. All this would flood in and completely dismantle their paradigm, and that's why they have to resist it.
Certainly. Now, speaking of education, what is your educational background? Are you university trained? How did you come to this knowledge of, was it through experience, the archaeological knowledge?
Yes, it was through experience. I went to Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. And I was going there as a history minor and as a journalism major. And this place that I mentioned earlier, the Monk's Mound, Cahokia, across the Mississippi River, is something that I visited by accident. I was already a junior at the university, and I had heard absolutely nothing. None of my professors told me anything about Cahokia, which was about an hour and a half's drive away. And I just happened to visit it one day by accident because there was so much traffic building up on the expressway. I was going to St. Louis just to have fun. We'd go there on the weekends just to enjoy the city. And I got off the expressway to see what these Indian mounds were. I thought, just some little heaps of earth. I'm standing before this gigantic pyramid straight out of either Egypt or Mesopotamia. And I went back to my history professor. I said, "How come you never told us about this?" He said, "Well, it's not really as significant as you think," he told me.
Oh. All that dirt, huh?
So I figured, something is wrong here, and it's not me.
Right.
So that really opened the door. He said, won't get around to explaining that. Well, they never did.
Right.
My education came and went, and they never brought it up. And every time I would bring up questions like this, like, "Who made that thing?" "Well, the Native Americans made it." I said, "Really? Well, the Native Americans themselves say that it was their ancestors made it, but under the direction of these white-skinned foreigners." "Oh, well, that's just some kind of fantasy they've lived through, and that's the end of that." So I think that was the beginning of my real education, as it were.
Now, inasmuch as some of the writers for ancient American magazine belong to the establishment, do any of them write under a pseudonym to maintain their occupational standing?
Not that I know of. Most of the people that we have write for the magazine are not mainstream. We've had a few come over. Dr. Gunnar Thompson is a PhD, as a matter of fact, University of Hawaii. And he doesn't use a pseudonym. He is a very brave man. He stands out in the open, and he declares that, yes, there were these tremendous influences at work. But most of the people that write for the magazine, they do not have the connections with mainstream archaeology, but they are some very brilliant people. One of the fellows that we have is Lee Pennington. He's a former, he's a Pulitzer Prize nominee for his writing, his historical writings, and he has written about the discovery of literally hundreds of Roman coins that have been found throughout the American Midwest. Not much beyond the Mississippi, but these coins are found in places like Tennessee, Kentucky, Illinois, Wisconsin, and he's written some really wonderful articles about that. So we have, I think, some very qualified people, also just ordinary people. This one guy was out in Ohio just looking for all kinds of treasure with his metal detector. All of a sudden, he comes up with this unusual pendant he'd never seen before. It was beautifully made. Couldn't figure it out what it was. Sent it to us. We looked at it. We recognized it immediately. The representation on this pendant he found belongs to Minoan Crete. It is a Minoan artifact that's related to the moon goddess. It's remarkable. That's also about 3,000 years old. Found it in Ohio. So that's the great thing about the magazine. It really is open to a broad spectrum of people, regardless of their backgrounds. We don't kick somebody out and ignore them just because they don't have a university training.
Have any of these establishment people had a problem in writing for the magazine? Have any of their colleagues said, why are you associated with this?
Well, the best answer I can give to that is a fellow by the name of Michael D. Coe, C-O-E. He's now retired. He's one of the most important archaeologists that America has ever produced. He's the discoverer of the Olmec civilization. The Olmecs are the earliest known civilized people that created a great high culture in Mexico, on the east coast of Mexico. And he was a mainstream archaeologist all his life. He towed the conventional line. But after he retired, he came out and spoke about a kind of an academic mafia. That's the word he used, the term he used, which prevents people from talking about what we're discussing right now. And he mentioned the influences from Indonesia, he said, in Mexico, for example, are beyond question. But he couldn't talk about them when he was tenured because he would lose his job. But now he talks about them after he's retired. That's I think, one just a small, typical example. This man is the doyen of Mesoamerican studies.
Now, I'm assuming that Frank Joseph is your name. You're not using a pen name?
No, that's it.
So Joseph is the surname that you were born with?
Yes.
Okay. What did you do before 1993? Were you associated with this field? Were you in what did you do?
Well, I worked in a number of newspapers. I worked mostly magazines. I also spent a lot of time doing research. I had an opportunity to travel around the world several times. What I did mostly is I worked as a motorcycle courier. And I saved all my pennies, and I would go on these long trips around the world. And the research that I collected by going to Polynesia and North Africa and Western Europe, I've been able to put into my books since then.
And you paid for all of these trips yourself?
I paid for them all myself. Like I said, I worked as a motorcycle courier in Chicago. I worked at a place called Deadline Express. As a matter of fact, I guess I can say that because I don't think they exist anymore. You don't see many motorcycle couriers anymore, come to think of it. Too dangerous, I suppose. Some of us did get killed, as it turns out. But what I worked at as a motorcycle courier, I saved my money, and then I see you read so much, you really have to go and visit these places to sort of verify with your own physical experience if what you're seeing, what you're reading about is correct. Because you, anytime you read something, you're mostly reading somebody else's opinion, of course. Even the most unbiased and objective person that puts their own bias into it. So by traveling to the extent that I did, I traveled for about 12 years.
Oh, my goodness. Now, yeah. how long were you a courier?
I was a courier from, I think, 1985 until for about 10 years, till 1995. Because in 1995, I left Chicago and I settled in St. Paul, where I was a marketing director for a publishing house.
Okay, so you didn't actually, and you also joined the magazine Ancient American in 1993.
Well, it wasn't anything to join back then. Wayne May suggested that we started, and so we worked on it together, and we created the first issues, and we've been together ever since.
Right. And so what did you do before 1985?
Well, like I say, before 1995, I was a courier. I was a courier from 1985 to 95, and my chief job then was I felt I was a student. I was consumed with these questions, and there wasn't any place you could really go to learn these things. So I just read and read and took my notes, and all I could think about was someday writing these wonderful things up after I had learned more about them. And
right.
So then yeah, I began, like I said, I began traveling in 80, well, actually I began traveling even earlier than that, 83 I guess it was, I began my first trips to Mexico. So I've been to so many places I can't have to stop and think all the places
right.
I've been.
So what did you do before 1983 as a profession?
Well, 1983 I was writing, I was doing magazine articles. I've been a writer all my life. I finished my education in the 70s, and so I worked mostly as different as freelancing. I worked at a couple of small magazines.
Okay, so from the time you graduated in 1970s to 1983, you were a independent writer?
Mm-hmm, that's correct. Yeah, freelance, uh-huh.
Okay.
And then, of course, you don't make much money as a freelance writer, that's for sure. Not enough to travel. So that's when I figured, well, I'm going to have to get some money somehow, and I figured the best way to do that was to risk my life by delivering architect's plans and other stranger things than that.
Sure. So you weren't married at this time that you were?
No, I wasn't. I couldn't be married at that time. My wife wouldn't allow me to get on a motorcycle today.
Right. Inasmuch as the first part of this book is about physical evidence, you do believe that these ancient artifacts provide scientific evidence that absolutely trumps popular, long-held, accepted beliefs. And there are many other areas in which people have readily accepted theories because of their pervasive media popularity. So do you think that the media, and you've already indicated what you think of the educational system, but do you think that the media can drive the so-called vehicle that makes us all believe things that really aren't true?
Well, I believe that's exactly the case. I think that every time I turn on the television, I feel like I'm looking at toxic waste. I don't really think that the media serves, well, that's an entire different subject, I suppose, but my opinion of the media in general is extremely low, and I feel it is a complete cultural failure, put it that way, a total, absolute cultural failure.
Certainly.
One example I can give of that is, after Scott Walter has spent, I don't know how many thousands of dollars and tens of thousands of dollars of his own money and his time, his expertise on the Kensington Runestone, and he had a press conference. He thought, God, this is really important. Naive fellow that he was. And so he had this press conference, and they showed up, and they took all the information that he had. He explained it in everyday language that, yes, the Kensington Runestone was definitely done by the people that came after the Vikings, you know, medieval Scandinavians, blah, blah, blah. They were here in Minnesota and all that. He showed how it was done, not theory, but how it was done, how it's proved. And then the press release that came out the following day took an incredibly denigrating tone and regarded
Frank,
as a hoax.
We've got the music. We do have to take a break. We'll be right back in 3 minutes. Our guest today is Frank Joseph, the former editor-in-chief and now a correspondent of the Ancient American magazine. Its website is ancientamerican.com. And you were talking about a hoax before we went to the break. And
it's not the hoax. It's just that when the Kensington runestone was made available to the national media, they responded by saying that it was a hoax. They just dismissed all of the evidence, didn't even discuss it. And so readers were left with the impression that this was just some silly thing that some guy tried to pull the wool over the archaeologist's eyes, and that's the end of it. This is something that should have, the Kensington runestone is something that should have completely changed the textbooks, but it didn't. It was ignored. And that is the level of cultural awareness that we have in this country. See, but we're going to know all the information about Tiger Woods' golf score, but we won't know anything about the Kensington runestone.
Correct. I did have an email message. It's from Greg, and he says, very interesting subject and guest tonight. Thank you for your shows. He says, I have looked into the work of alternative historians such as Michael Tesserian, Ralph Ellis, and they have come up with startling theories and factual evidence of civilization going far back, far earlier than we have been taught. And perhaps we've already covered this, but he asked, I would appreciate your continuing comment and your guest comments on why does establishment archaeology, establishment geology continue to deny this evidence? What is the agenda behind this their mentality? Can't say that word. That's a
I don't think there's any, I understand what he's trying to say. I don't think there's any single explanation for it, but it appears to be primarily fear. It's fear of their fellow colleagues, what they're going to say.
Okay.
And you can get drummed out of a profession. I don't want to harp on this too much because it really is not as important as the issues that you've brought up. But I can think of one case in particular. Belongs to a woman by the name of Virginia Steen McIntyre. She was a university-trained archaeologist and a specialist in dating materials that had been burned, fire-affected materials. She was called in by the archaeological establishment to examine a campfire, which was considered to be very old, outside of Mexico City in the 1970s. Virginia Steen McIntyre went through her process, which, by the way, she helped pioneer, and she was able to determine that this campfire was indeed set by human beings a very long time ago, and that her analysis showed that this campfire was lit outside of Mexico City a quarter of a million years ago, 250,000 years ago. Now, mainstream archaeologists tell us that the very first human beings didn't arrive in Mexico until about maybe 9 or 10,000 years ago. She persisted in saying, no, my testing has been redone eventually for 10 years, and she was right, and she suffered for it.
All righty. Okay, we do have to take our 60-second top of the hour break. We will be right back after station ID with our guest today, Frank Joseph.